out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday the 9th of July 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, today we are welcoming back an old friend to the show to find out how his life has been since leaving the NSM and getting involved in Unite the Right lawsuits. And of course, that is Matthew Heimbach. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome, Sven. Special shout out to all of your listeners, especially all the ones that have stayed in touch. Love you guys, absolutely. And it's a real great opportunity to be here. Hopefully you're doing well as well, Sven.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. And I'll just say, things I said about you before, they weren't personal things. And listeners should know that we've always remained friends during that time. And it was criticisms of activism, really, and just choices that you made, but not personal attacks. And I think you've understood that. I mean, we've stayed in touch all this time, and we're not really going to get into that today. But I think what we should really talk about is the National Socialist Movement and what happened there, because we haven't really heard from you since then. You did an interview with Chris Cantwell, and everything seemed to be going well with the NSM, and then they suddenly dropped you, and then after that handed the movement over to a black civil rights activist or something. Crazy stuff. Anyway, tell us what really happened, Matt.
Well, the National Socialist Movement had, and I know it still technically exists, but I'm just going to speak in the past tense out of respect for the decades of activism that they had done, had been in existence for decades. Jeff Scoop is a guy that, one of the most important things that there's a lot of criticism of him, a lot of things that are untrue, a lot of things that, he could have done better. He's been involved in this movement since he was a teenager, right? And he's in his 40s now. And but things had stagnated with the National Socialist Movement. Going back to 2014, 2015, we helped them redesign their logo. We were helping them update their website and getting them new banners and really trying to bring them up. Because one of the big principles I've always believed in nationalism is that we're all in this together, right? Like, it's not about one organization or one crew, that the survival of European civilization, European peoples, all of humanity, when you look at, the Jewish financier plan for the planet, we're all kind of in this together, right? So we should always try and collaborate. And of course, a year ago, the National Socialist Movement and Jeff Scoop, some of their leadership, approached me and said, look, things are not exactly moving forward. Membership is stagnant. There isn't really a drive when it comes to moving things forward. The 25 points of the NSM really wasn't even National Socialist in a lot of ways. I mean, some of it was copy-pasted from the NSDAP platform, which didn't make sense in an American context. And a lot of it kind of missed the spirit, I think, of National Socialism. If you look at, say, Golden Dawn or, fascism with Forza Nova or other organizations in Europe. So it was all about like an update and a rebrand to kind of try and bring the National Socialist Movement into the family of National Socialist organizations around the world, out of kind of the cliquishness of American 1980s, 1990s white nationalism we've all seen on the History Channel documentaries. And unfortunately, while Jeff Scoop really seemed to be dedicated to having some ideas, I worked with him, rewrote the 25 points, designed a new logo, got a new uniform that was, I think, very appropriate, looked good, working class, and then came an event in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it was about South Africa to raise awareness. This is, when Trump had recently, at the time, posted about the farm attacks, and that was getting a lot of traction. So we were trying to raise awareness about that, about the abuses of the Afrikaners and the Boers. And unfortunately, a lot of the rank and file membership did not see the vision that not only myself, and I'm not going to say, oh, look, I'm a visionary. No, but Jeff Scoop and others in the organization that wanted to move it forward, they had no interest in becoming a fully functional national socialist political organization, engaging in local politics, getting back to the activities that they used to do, like road cleanups and engaging in charity events. They would rather be, I don't want to say the word gang, because of course it has a connotation of illegal activity, and I never saw any or anything like that, but more of a clique, more of a tribe instead of a political entity. So at that point, and sorry for the long-winded rant, but it seems to me that I penned my resignation, and Kynan Dutton, who ended up leaving their organization anyway, accused me of being a communist and all sorts of stuff because of my support of the socialism element of National Socialism, and said, you know, you can't resign, you're fired. And Jeff Scoop was caught in a bad situation, and I ended up, you know, resigning, and we can go into that. But very shortly after, it looks like Jeff was kind of the perspective, and this is me. I haven't spoken to him, so this is my interpretation after knowing him for 7-8 years, that if kind of the rank and file was unwilling to adapt and change, it was more like a ship that had hit an iceberg, like the Titanic that was going to sink, and him signing over the organization, if you read kind of some of these documents, he was not trying to help a black civil rights organizer or stuff like that. He was basically saying if the NSM was not going to be a national socialist organization, if they were not going to follow his leadership and when he brought people in to try and update it, if they didn't want to go along with that, then he was going to scuttle the ship, basically. And that's my interpretation of events as I saw them. And yeah, it's a heck of a headline, though, isn't it? NSM headed by black civil rights organizer.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, really bizarre. I mean, he was talking about some legal reason why he was doing that, which I mean, maybe that ties in with the Unite the Right rally, which is, you know, this other legal issue that you're having problems with. I mean, it's a good thing that the NSM was standing up for the white farmers, but I can see what you mean that they're more like a tribe. I mean, I would suggest maybe it was more like an old school reunion, and they didn't really want to progress, and maybe they just wanted to meet up and drink beer and you know, and talk down about ethnic minorities without really knowing the reasons for doing that. I mean, I saw an interview with them, and that they didn't really seem to understand the reasons, the good scientific reasons for being a nationalist. It just seemed that they were, you know, they just didn't like black people, but didn't actually know why. And when they had this brown reporter who got friendly with them, at the end of it, they were saying, oh, yes, you can stay in the ethnostate. And then it became clear that they didn't even know what an ethnostate was. I mean, it defeats the object if you have somebody with a different DNA that's also there in the ethnostate. It's no longer an ethnostate then. And they didn't seem to understand that, you know?
Well, and I think this actually ties in if you go back to look at NSDAP, propaganda, right, to the 1940s, where you've got the image of America. It's one of my favorite propaganda posters, you know, where it's a golem made out of bombs with a Masonic apron on with a Star of David on it. And it's got a Klan hood on the top. And I think it's a very interesting thing to kind of evaluate throughout American history of like reactionary white supremacy versus National Socialism. Those are very, very different things. You know, for instance, there are a couple commentators that I really liked their work as of late, discussing how we see increasingly in the conservative and reactionary movement, there's almost a latent kind of white supremacy being promoted against China, right, or against Iran. And we saw this, of course, in the lead up to the Iraq War and stuff like that. Of course, the elites, the bankers, the Zionists, I mean, the whole kit and caboodle, the traitorous whites, they actually don't care about white people, but they will kind of tap into a root of, you know, kind of white resentment, you know, at our own demographic displacement or economic problems and stuff like that, to then use us as cannon fodder for the regime. And in a weird sort of way, and I'm sure we could dig into this, but it's almost like the NSM ideologically for a long time has just been like turbo conservative, right? Not not revolutionary, not really national socialist. And even, and you can see this in a lot of organizations, I think, over the last, you know, the post-Rockwell era, where they might have the symbols, they might even have some of the talking points, but as you said, they're missing almost a scientific understanding of the worldview, of nationalism, of the ideology, of history, of why we love our people, why we want a future for our children, why it's not about just hating people who are different than us, or hating them at all. It's about love and cultivation of what's good, and that's where environmentalism comes in. That's why, you know, when you talk about the socialism aspect for workers, it's about a spirit of justice for your family and wanting to have a planet that your kids and grandkids and so on can live on. And that really wasn't kind of on their ideological radar, if you know what I mean.
Well, the original social justice warrior was Father Coughlin. I mean, he was a fascist, and it was the fascists that were first talking about the environment. Blood and soil is central to it all. I think what you're sort of defining there is jingoism, also referred to as chauvinism or petty chauvinism, rather than proper nationalism. And they don't understand that. I think they just like the image of the Nazi, because it shocks people. I think that plays into it as well. And I know they gave up wearing the copies of the World War II era uniforms quite some time back, but I think that mentality was still there. And George Lincoln Rockwell just wanted to use that as stage one, and they were supposed to get past that. That was just supposed to be used to get publicity back in the late 60s, I believe. So to still be sort of stuck there at stage one years later, it's a real shame that's what Rockwell's legacy turned into, I think, because he was really far ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Well, and that's one of the most important things. I think one of the events and we've talked about it before, but that's really underreported is when Commander Rockwell went to the outskirts of Chicago, when Martin Luther King and the civil rights organizers, while they had defeated segregation in the South on a legal level, they were getting involved in what's known as blockbusting, where basically, you know, white Italian or Polish or Irish communities couldn't remain that way. They couldn't have housing associations to restrict not just, this wasn't just about keeping people of color out of neighborhoods. It's saying, you know, oh, this is a Polish neighborhood, right? It's got an identity to it. This is an Irish neighborhood, an Italian neighborhood, you know, an Anglo neighborhood. They were coming in to do blockbusting, right? To basically say that you can't have a white ethnic community, even on the local level, where we're talking about a couple of blocks. I mean, you know, in the United States now, South Boston, which for hundreds of years was known as like the Irish stronghold, it's really a part of kind of the American experience, is majority not Irish. And I know a guy in Boston who's a comrade, and you know, South Boston has been gentrified by all these soy boys and hippies and yoga studios, and the old Irish have basically been driven out. But Rockwell went to oppose the blockbusting outside of Chicago, and he had thousands, literally thousands. And I didn't even know about this till I actually went to the Martin Luther King Museum in Atlanta, where they had footage of it. I live nearby, and I didn't even know about it. And I'm pretty well read on this history, but he got thousands of whites to march behind him. And it was huge. And that's never reported, because it was a huge show of white working class resistance to the social engineering project that the elites are trying to push on us, where they won't even allow us to have a couple of neighborhoods for ourselves. And at that point, Commander Rockwell, you know, they dropped using Sieg Heil, which they were using, and they were talking about white power. And of course, that fit into the same time as, you know, the black power activists like Stokely Carmichael were talking about blacks having their own communities, having their own nations. You know, Stokely Carmichael ends up going back to Africa to organize his own people there, and about how whites could do that in the United States. And they were moving to this next stage of being a political entity for white people, for white Americans. And then he's assassinated, right? So his legacy is one where he was moving towards this political project where he could literally get thousands of people, including World War II veterans, into the streets to stand up for their communities. But all people remember is kind of the Jewish caricature, which I think is unfair to Commander Rockwell and his legacy. But it's almost a parody, kind of a twisted image of what he was actually doing. And when we become, instead of fighting for our people, fighting for our culture, making sure there's a future, when we instead just become the stories and the images of boogeymen that the Jewish media creates, well, we're not really nationalists at that point. We're actually just kind of doing a bit fulfilling the outlines that they've created for us. And that's a real disservice to our people.
Yeah, it's fulfilling a negative role, like a caricature or a stereotype that they have created. I mean, it's a great shame that has actually happened, really, because you do get, types that you really don't want involved in nationalism that are drawn to it because they believe the stories about the gas chambers. They believe that the Nazis were the greatest evil on earth, and they're pretty wicked people that may be into drugs and all sorts, and you don't want them involved in nationalism, and the only reason they're there is because of this false caricature of what nationalist is that is presented by the media, and of course the most recent example of that is the caricature that's been made of the people that went to the Unite the Right rally, the patriots who went there to defend the statues, who were then cast by the media as being white supremacists that were all looking for a fight. We've had people that have been locked up. We've got people that have been locked up for years, basically, for defending themselves. And you're now facing a lawsuit, even though the organization that you were leading is no longer even functioning. It's no longer an organization, and yet you are still being held liable for this match. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about what's been happening with this lawfare against you over the Unite the Right rally?
Yeah, of course. And there's some things I can't get into, and I'm sure the listeners understand. But for folks that don't know, especially those outside of the United States, shortly after Unite the Right, a lawsuit was filed against over 20 individuals and organizations. And if you read it, it's a 112-page document, right, that they put forward, where they're basically trying to sue everybody. And, you know, over the past year or so, it recently came out in an interview, Roberta Kaplan, who was one of the head counsels for the other side, she is actually what was involved in the landmark Supreme Court case, herself individually and her law firm, and arguing gay marriage in front of the Supreme Court and getting that passed as the law of the land. So these are not ambulance chasing attorneys. These are actually some of the highest paid, most privileged, and truly, I mean that, most privileged attorneys in the entire country with the most power. And Roberta Kaplan recently said in an interview on a Jewish publication that, the purpose of this lawsuit is not to get money. It's specifically to basically try and stop white nationalist organizing, because as we know with Unite the Right, what happened in that event was we had a permit, right? A federal, the Charlottesville had pulled the permit. A federal judge in the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, went to court the night before and got it upheld because there was absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be able to have a permitted rally to oppose the removal of Confederate statues. That sort of thing is upheld in American Supreme Court law going back centuries at this point. And of course, we were attacked by mobs of anti-fascists and the police specifically. If no one's gotten the chance to read the Heathy report, it was the independent review done after Charlottesville, Unite the Right, where they had quotes from police that police officers were ordered by their superiors to stand down, to quote unquote, let them fight. And what that means is, let anti-fascists attack us as we were trying to go to a rally that a federal judge upheld our right to go to, which is a clear violation of our civil rights, and that they wanted there to be conflict. They let the anti-fascists attack us. Then they, of course, declared an unlawful assembly and were then able to use the might of the state and all of their police to drive us away from our permitted rally before we could even give our speeches. And everything kind of comes on from there. So what's interesting about this is I've actually just recently filed this week a motion to dismiss on my part, kind of taking apart all of their claims, because the lawyers on the other side were, I think, incredibly sloppy that, for instance, they accused me individually and the Traditionalist Worker Party of being involved in the events of August 11th, which, of course, was the so-called torch march the night before. Well, I wasn't even there, and our guys weren't even there. I specifically told them not to be there. But instead they claim that they claim that we brought weapons. And of course, the only thing that we had were defensive things like helmets, where I got hit in the head with a bat at Unite the Right. And if I hadn't been wearing a helmet, my brains would have been on, you know, on the streets of Charlottesville. I mean, this is the sort of thing that we knew in the weeks leading up, that the police, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, they were releasing reports that anti-fascists were coming with weapons. They were coming with bottles that were filled with concrete or frozen water to use as projectiles. So of course, you're going to have something to protect your noggin, you know, when the other side is saying they're going to come and try and bash it in, right? You know, when you actually lay out the facts of the case, the only reason we were there was to oppose the cultural genocide of the removal of these statues, what that symbolizes. And, you know, when it comes to all the violence, that is only on two parties. The police that specifically wanted that to happen so they could call an unlawful assembly, and the anti-fascists that traveled from around the country not to stand for an image, because there were plenty of counter-protesters. And I want to just say this and give the peaceful ones on the other side some credit, that there were counter-demonstrations, peace vigils and stuff like that, where people who opposed us peacefully protested. I respect that right. That's their constitutional First Amendment right to disagree with us, just like we can disagree with them. But it was the anti-fascists that came with weapons specifically to shut down our freedom of speech. That's a violation of our civil rights. And of course, Joe Biden launched his presidential campaign by glorifying these violent anti-fascists who even created things like medieval weaponry, where they had giant things of wood with ladders bolted to the back to try and use to bulldoze us over as we were trying to get into the demonstration. You know, that they're the ones that caused the violence, that we held, you know, the rally in Pikeville, Kentucky, just before Unite the Right. Two sides opposed, totally peaceful. We had a rally in Shelbyville, Tennessee, after Unite the Right, totally peaceful. I mean, Sven, I've seen you in different countries. We've gone to demonstrations, totally peaceful. The only thing that changes here is when the police specifically allow the anti-fascists to commit violence to further the police's and their political master's political agenda, and the Antifa bring violence. We are nonviolent. We believe that the truth of our message can win out, but now that they weren't able to achieve all their objectives in August of 2017, they're using the highest paid, highest priced lawyers they possibly can to basically try and make it impossible that even if you get a permit, even if you're trying to just utilize your First Amendment rights to speak up for our culture, our identity, for our people, that they can then sue you and take everything you have. That this is just the next stage of warfare by using lawfare against peaceful white nationalists. And I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, but it is really stunning when you sit down and break down the facts about how every single step of the way, we were the peaceful law-abiding ones, and they were the ones that were promoting this you know, situation and caused the violence.
Well, yeah, you guys had a permit. This is what I don't really understand, how she can win. I mean, you had a permit. You went there with a permit. There was a group of people there without a permit who attacked you. You defended yourselves against them, and now she's trying to sue you for all the damage that was caused. I mean, what is she saying, that you should have just sat back and taken a beating? Is she going to try and suggest that you shouldn't have fought back because the police were there and the police were going to defend you because the police were told to stand down? And there's evidence of that. I mean, what is she really sort of hoping to achieve from this? What sort of precedent is it that she's wanting to get?
Well, I think the precedent primarily is yes, we don't, it's not even about the ability of self-defense. We don't have the ability to organize, because a large portion of this is they just throw buzzwords. And I would encourage anyone who hasn't read Sines v. Kessler, it's available online. It's a 112-page document. And it basically, it's almost entirely emotional, okay? What they say in this claim is basically that because of what we believe, because we were then holding a public demonstration, we were there to, quote unquote, intimidate. No, actually we weren't. The reason we were there was to support the statue. People seem to forget we had held a peaceful rally in Charlottesville before this. Charlottesville 2.0, you know, was Unite the Right, but Charlottesville 1.0, there was a demonstration specifically in the exact same location, where there was no intimidation, there was no violence, right? It was speaking about the importance of our cultural monuments and our history, and opposing the removal. The only factor that changes is in August 12, 2017, is that these mobs of anti-fascists with weapons are allowed by the police to attack us. So the thing is this could actually become a defining First Amendment case. Now, of course, this is civil, not criminal. I don't think it's going to be going to the Supreme Court or anything. It doesn't really fit in that wheelhouse. But in terms of we've got to win this case by telling the truth about what happened, because if high-priced attorneys are able to essentially destroy and dismantle the First Amendment, they'll never make the First Amendment illegal. They'll never get rid of it. They will just make it prohibitive for people that say things that violent leftists disagree with, that you can't organize. That's the precedent. It's actually trying to do the total shutdown like they've been doing online, where anywhere where people speak that they disagree with, they ban their accounts, they ban their ability to have bank accounts, all that stuff. This is doing it in the public space, and they're not doing it through criminal prosecution because we didn't break any laws. So they're trying to use really kind of a knee-jerk emotional reaction where they, for instance, bring in the incident with James Fields, and somehow that applies to all of us, I guess, based upon ideology, but I didn't know James Fields. James Fields wasn't a member of my organization. No one knew James Fields, you know, and we could spend like 10 episodes just talking about the James Fields incident, but the idea that, you know, when you get over 1,000 people in one place, that when one thing happens with one individual, then that can somehow blow back and supposedly destroy the constitutional rights of everyone else who's assembled is ludicrous. But I think they think that they've got enough money and power and sympathetic media that they can just bulldoze the First Amendment and make it almost impossible for white nationalists to organize publicly, even when we follow all the rules and all the laws.
So they're trying to say that because of your ideals, because of your beliefs, voicing them publicly is going to cause this sort of thing to happen, so therefore you must be prevented from speaking your beliefs publicly. Is that the argument, yeah, basically?
Well, they say, for instance, in their claim that we brought images of the Holocaust and images of Jim Crow and stuff like that with us. I don't particularly even know what that means, right? Other than I didn't see anyone carrying around a sign of Treblinka or something like that, right?
I would imagine what they mean by that is somebody had a swastika flag, one person, nobody knows who it was, and it was clearly just being taken out of the bag. It still had the creases in it. Somebody had the swastika flag. I bet they're trying to say that is images of the Holocaust. And when they say images of Jim Crow laws, I should imagine that was probably the Confederate flag. That's probably what they're trying to make.
And all these things are protected symbols. I mean, Skokie v. Village of Illinois, which was a very defining free speech case, clarified that, you know, you can march with symbols and stuff like that that might even be inflammatory. And in my recent motion to dismiss, I also cite a case that relates specifically to the Westboro Baptist Church, because, of course, they have a particularly inflammatory, I don't believe, and this is something that people forget, a poll done right after Unite the Right said 57% of Virginians, which would include then a large number of people of color, not just white folks, supported leaving Confederate monuments where they were. So we actually had the majority opinion, and we forget sometimes how many people agree with us, even different racial groups that don't buy into the propaganda that's put out, that don't believe in just bulldozing history. So we actually had the majority opinion in the state or the Commonwealth of Virginia when it comes to our monuments. So it's not even that controversial. But free speech has been protected even if something is controversial, that we have a right if it's of a public importance, of which I think statues being torn down is of public importance, that we're allowed to speak. So if the Westboro Baptist Church has the protection to picket funerals, which is very, very controversial, I don't think taking the majority opinion of the people of Virginia when it comes to these monuments even falls into being controversial, maybe in Charlottesville. But we have all of the rights to fly whatever flags we did. And, you know, we weren't even flying Confederate flags. You know, we had our own party flags. We weren't using historical symbols at all. We had our own thing. And they're trying to lump everybody together. And I think a clear violation of settled case law. And, you know, allegedly, you know, some people raise their voices at a synagogue or something. One thing I think is funny, not to harbor on every little minutia, but the way that myself and the Traditionalist Worker Party, that we even entered the park, was on the opposite side of where that synagogue was. So we didn't have anything to do with that. Yet they're citing in their claim that every single thing that involved every single person apparently applies to everyone instead of basing it on what people actually did. Because if they had to base it on the facts, this case would have been thrown out, I think, over a year ago.
So they're trying to make prominent people liable for the actions of everybody else, basically. And you're saying you're having to defend this on your own, Matt, are you? You haven't got an attorney? Are you having to do this all by yourself?
Yeah, well, as it stands, you know, I couldn't afford to be able to retain counsel. I mean, I think most folks know me. You know, I'm just kind of a working class guy. And what it would take to retain an attorney when nothing was really even going on in the case would be more money than my rent, car insurance, phone, internet, like, I mean, you know, basically all my expenses just to keep one retained. And the majority of attorneys won't touch this case. And I think this is also one of the reasons they're doing it in civil court, because in criminal court, of course, you are guaranteed under the Constitution to have legal representation. But in a civil lawsuit, you are not required to be given representation. So, yeah, I'm now a pro se self-made attorney at this point, you know, filing my own motions. And I've had to get into the trenches of reading law books and, I mean, really figuring out how to properly defend myself as an individual. And it's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. I mean, I've spent so much time going through Supreme Court cases, federal court cases. We are so right. It is absolutely painful. And I look forward, actually, to when this goes forward, too, because they want a jury trial. I think when I can be able to stand in front of, you know, my peers, right, fellow citizens, that they will be able to see that we were the ones that were in the right. We were the ones that were trying to peacefully protest. We've got every constitutional right to do it. And, you know, this is a whole lot of smoke and mirrors by the other side. But yeah, as of now, I'm my own attorney.
Well, I think you're a pretty competent guy. And if anyone stands a chance of, you know, of being able to do that job and defeating this, then you do. So, you know, best of luck with it, Matt. And thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Carolyn Yeager. God bless and hail victory.